Good morning and Chanukah Sameach. I just wanted to give a little bit of background of why I chose this topic and why I'm doing it on Chanukah, and I promise you to try and connect it to Chanukah towards the end. But in reality, the two Tanakh classes I'm teaching this semester are Sefer Shmuel and Sefer Vayikra. And towards the end of the summer, when I was preparing both of them, it was unbelievable to me how many cross-references there were between the two Sfarim. Namely, the end of Perek Yutet had a series of Isurim, and that all the narrative examples were coming from Shmuel Aleph. And it intrigued me to no end why so many of them are specifically found in this portion of our history. And that's what I would like to explore with you today. So that's the end point towards where we're trying to get to, which will take us to the end of Malchut Beit Shaul and lay the foundation for Malchut Beit David, which is why we don't see the similar problems after Shaul dies. But in order to start that, we're going to take a step back and look at what the role of a king is supposed to be. And that's going to be source number one on our source sheets. And Devarim Yitzayin, Parshat Shoftim, is very famous for introducing to us the mitzvah. And there's in fact a debate among the Rishonim whether the psukim imply a mitzvah to say, something that we must do, or whether it implies a reshut, which is the position of the Abarbanel, the Rambam, and the Ramban feel it's a chovah, whether we can appoint a king if we want to, but we're not commanded to do so. I'd like to look with you at those psukim to lay the foundation for either what the people want as a king and what Hashem wants as a king. So rather than go into the traditional debate, mitzvah or reshut, to look at it as coming from two different points of view, what B'nai Israel seem to want and what HaKadosh Baruch Hu seems to want. So in source number one, Devarim Yudzayin Yudalith, Ki tavo el haaretz, asher Hashem lukecha noten lach, v'irashta v'yishavta ba, v'amarta asima alai melech kechol hagoyim asher sivivotai. This seems to be the position of the people, that when they'll get to the land where other people live, they're going to look around them after they've conquered the land, and we want a king too, like everyone else is around us. We want to have that same sort of role model in front of us. Hashem will counter, Som tasim alecha melech, asher yivchar Hashem lokecha bo. Fine, you can have a king, but you have to be the one, he has to be chosen by God. He has to be fit for the job. Mikerev achicha tasim alecha melech, lo tuchal latet alecha ish nachri, asher lo achicha hu. He has to come from amongst you. And he has a certain amount of obligations that he must adhere to in order to remain to be king. And again, these are famous mitzvot. We're going to look at them specifically for what Hashem wants from his king. What is the ideal? Rak lo yarbe lo susim, v'lo yashiva ta'am mitzrayma, leman harbot sus. He cannot have too many horses. He cannot rely too heavily on Egypt, which harks back to our original association with Egypt, where they were the source of power. Whether we liked it or not, they provided our food, they had us work. When they let us stop. And we're not allowed to rely on them again. Hashem is now the one on whom we rely. So if you can't have horses, remember Hashem is in charge of you. You can't continue in the way you once had this relationship with Egypt. Lo yarbe lo nashim, v'lo yasur levavo, v'chesef zahav lo yarbe lo me'od. Can't have too many wives in order to turn his heart astray. Can't have too much gold. V'yakishiv tov yisem amlachto, v'katav lo t'mishne ha-torah hazot, asefer melifnei ha-konim ha-levihim, v'aytaymo v'karabo kol yimei chayav, leman yilmad yirat Hashem lukav, lishmur kol divrei ha-torah hazot, v'dafukim ha-ele la'asotam. And what does he have to do? He has to have an additional Sefer Torah, Munach Lepanav, placed in front of him for all time, to teach him Yirat Hashem, because ultimately that is going to be his role, to model Yirat Hashem for the rest of B'nai Israel, to make sure that as he is doing the mitzvot and chukim, so too are B'nai Israel. And Levilti Rum Levavo Me'echav, Levilti Sur Min HaMitzvah Yamin U'Smol. He has to really be a religious role model for everybody. That is the conception of a king according to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Is such a role model necessary? If you look throughout Parshat Shoftim, you'll see very many different types of leaders that are listed. There's a spiritual leader in the form of the Navi, a religious leader in the form of a Kohen, a judicial leader in the form of a judge. Do we really need a king? So the next segment, the next stories we're going to look at are the pre-monarchy stories to hopefully point out why a role model in the form of a king, somebody to unite the entire kingdom and serve as a model of what Shinarata Mitzvot should be about, is so totally necessary. So the first story I brought for you, I just brought a snippet of it because there were two psukim I wanted you to see. The first, Vayamim Ahem En Melech Yisrael, and it's a phrase that repeats a lot through the end of Sefer Shoftim. We'll see it again in the next source with a continuation of the pasuk, Ish Hayashar Be'inav Ya'aseh. Everybody does as they feel that is right. What is the story that demonstrates the lack of the king? The story of Pesel Micha. So this I'm just going to describe to you. I didn't want to put so much of the source in front. Micha, as we first meet him, has stolen a large amount of money from his mother. His mother, not knowing that her son was a thief, curses the thief, whereupon Micha decides to return the money. His mother, in order to counter the curse that she had just given to her son, not knowing it was her son, blesses her son, but decides to go along with a promise that if the money was returned, it would be mukdash, it would be dedicated to Hashem. How do they dedicate the money to Hashem? They build a pesel. And not only do they build a pesel, they acquire a mefod with which to adorn the pesel, and they get trafim as well. In all of these, we can see the influences of their Kanani neighbors and how now they are worshiping HaKadosh Baruch Hu. At first, Micha appoints his son to be a Kohen, to take care of this pesel and the ephod, because now he has a Beit Elohim. But then a real lady happens along, and Micha drafts him to the task. This Levi slash Kohen, he's from Shevet Levi, but he's not a Kohen, but he's working as if he were a Kohen in the Beit Elohim, is then drafted subsequently by a group of men from Shevet Dan who are on their way traveling north. They are not able to conquer the land that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had promised them. It is still controlled by the Plishtim. And this is where Shevet Dan moves up to the area of Laish. So this Kohen slash Levi is willing to be drafted to be a Kohen slash Levi for an entire group rather than for one person. And that's really what the pasuk that I brought in for you is. Bayamin Hahem, at the end of Pasuk Aleph, Shevet Dani Mefakesh Lo Nachala La Shevet Ki Lo Nachala Lo Ad Hayom Ahu V'Tol Shevet Yisrael B'Nachala. It's part of their whole inheritance story. Vayavru Misham Har Ephraim Vayavo Ad Beit Micha Vayanu Chameshet Anashim Ha'Olchim L'Ragel Et Ha'aretz La'ish Vayamru El Achayem Hayedatem Ki Yesh Babatim Ha'Ela Ephod U'Trafim U'Pesel U'Masecha. And it's really for those four words that I put in this excerpt, just to notice what was so prevalent and what they were looking for. And they're going to convince this person to come up with them to La'ish to serve in the Beit Elohim. And he does this. The story of Pesel Micha demonstrates a number of things. The easy substitution for a normative religious leader by another not of the correct lineage. And the prevalence of what we'll refer to as now Darchei Emori, that which is used to enhance Avodat Hashem, which has been copied by us from the Kananim and is not quite legit. We'll investigate the last term, the Darchei Emori, a little bit more in a few minutes. The story found after that of Pesel Micha at the end of Sefer Shoftim also features a member of Shevet Levi and also begins with the phrase En Melech Bisrael, Isha Yashar Be'inav Ya'aseh. Here we see another way in which Bnei Israel have learned from their neighbors, this time in the realm of social and moral behavior. When a man and his pelegesh are delayed in their journey home, they decide to spend the night in the area of Giv'ah in Nachalat Binyamin, since the Giv'ah is known to be inhabited by members of Bnei Israel, and they decide that instead of spending the night in the area of Yavuz, not of Bnei Israel. What they don't realize is that Giv'ah's twin city is that of Sodom, and a Sodom-like story emerges when the inhabitants of the city welcome the overnight guests into their midst by raping the woman visitor repeatedly until she dies. The husband, bent on revenge, assembles the tribe to go to war against Shevet Binyamin. While only one specific area in Nachalat Binyamin was guilty of killing and raping his pelegesh, the fact that the rest of the Shevet condoned their behavior because they made no move to correct the goings-on about town, sort of shares their involvement in the crime and then in the ultimate punishment. So what we see is a lowering of the moral behavior, of the social behavior, and of the religious behavior. Things don't improve much when we get to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel Aleph, and this is going to be source number 3. B'nai Israel have gone out to war against the Plishtim, and they lost the first round of the battle, and that's described in the first 3 psukim that I've given before you. What they decide to do is to bring out reinforcements, and I'm going to start to read from Pasuk Gimel. V'yavo ha'am el ha'machane v'yamru zikne Yisrael, lama negafnu Hashem hayom lifnei Plishtim, nikha elenu mishilo et aron brit Hashem, v'yavo b'kirbenu v'yoshienu mikaf oybenu. Why should we continue to perish at the hands of the Plishtim? I know what we should do, they say to one another. Let's go bring the aron from Shiloh, and it's going to help us win. Notice how they view it as a good luck charm. Usually when the Aron was brought to the Machane, and it was a customary practice, the Kohanim would begin with Divrei Tochacha, know that you're going into war, know that something has gone wrong, reflect, see what you can do to make yourself a better person, you're fighting for Am Hashem. They would encourage the people that if they've done Shuvah, and that they've looked and done well, Hashem will be on their side and they will win. There is nothing of that. Bring the Aron, get me my 4-leaf clover, go into war, and everything will be fine. Obviously, that's not how you look at the Aron, and obviously they're not going to be victorious. The one interesting point is that contrary to the B'nai Israel, who look at the Aron as a good luck charm, the people who realize that Bahashem el Hamachane are the Plishtim. And if you look with me at Pasuk Vav, Vayishmu plishtim et kol hatrua, they hear the sound of the shofar accompanying the aron. Vayamru ma kol hatrua hagdola hazot b'machane ha'ivrim, v'yidu ki aron Hashem ba el ha'machane. Oh, it's symbolizing the entree of the aron. Vayiru ha'plishtim, and they are fearful. Ki amru ba elokim el ha'machane. God has come into the camp. They know to be scared. They know that the aron is representative of a far greater power. They have the necessary awe. They win the war. It certainly doesn't help matters that the 2 Kohanim chosen to accompany the Aron, as we see at the end of Pasuk Dalet, are Hophni and Pinchas, already known to us in an earlier parak for being indicted in Mishpat HaKohanim and actions with the women. While it's not going to be the purpose now this year to go into what they exactly did wrong, we clearly have them sitting in some realm in the temple, in the religious rites, and in their social arena and how they were treating the women. So again, not a great state of affairs of B'nai Israel as we're entering into the monarchy before Shaul emerges. Shmuel is able to work wonders with B'nai Israel. And in source 4, we see some of what he's able to accomplish to take these people at their social, moral, religious level and to raise them up. And again, it's by reading between the lines we get a sense of where B'nai Israel were, seeing now what Shmuel has been able to accomplish with them. Now, 20 years after that original war, 20 years that the Aron has been in the hands, not back where it belongs. And they're finally beginning to follow Hashem. Notice how Shmuel has to admonish the people to get rid of the Avodah Zarah in their midst and to only worship God. It's not that they were at a level that they're only worshiping Avodah Zarah. They haven't swung quite that low. That's more for the end of Sefer Melachim. But there's still this mixture, this cocktail that we saw earlier with Micha, of using the Ashterot, using the Elohei Nechar as an aid to help them lavod et Hashem. Says Shmuel, you can't have it both ways. You can't dance at the 2 weddings. You've got to choose which way you're going to. And B'nai Israel acquiesce. Vayasiru B'nai Israel and Pasuk Dalet et Baalim ve'et Ashterot ve'avdu et Hashem levavo. They remove all these extraneous forces and they are willing to worship only Hashem. What happens as a result, and it's a one-liner in the rest of the parak that I didn't put for you, but there's another battle with the Plishtim, where the earlier battle took a full parak. Here we have one line, and they're totally able to wipe out the Plishtim. Bing! 1, 2, 3. Not only do they wipe out the Plishtim, but Tashovna Ha'arim Asher Lakho HaPlishtim, the cities that the Plishtim had begun to take, they usurp as they're moving their way east from where they belong on the Chof Yam HaTichon, on the shore with the Mediterranean. They've been inching their way ever inward. They're now able to push themselves, Bnei Israel push the Plishtim all the way back to the Mediterranean, and the cities return to the hands of Bnei Israel. Not only that, the Pasuk tells us, Vayishalom, Bnei Israel uven ha'emori. Nations to the other side, the Amorim, are also now in a peaceful condition with Bnei Israel, all because of their change of behavior, all because of what Shmuel has been able to effect. What made Shmuel such an effective religious leader? The way in which he led. He was a shofet, he was also a Levi, but he was a shofet, but he would go around from city to city, and the end of the parak describes it again, it's part of the psukim you do not have in front. V'alach midei shana b'shana b'sabav beit el v'hagilgal v'hamitzveh v'shafatit Israel et kol mekumot ha'eleh. That every year he would go around where Bnei Israel were living, would come to their cities to judge whatever cases needed to be judged, to serve as this religious role model, to make sure Bnei Israel were doing that which is necessary. And in order to continue in his ways, he intends to establish his sons as shoftim. But there are a few problems. While Shmuel lived in the center of the civilization at that time, in Mitzveh, Ramah, Gilgal, he lived in that area, Ramah was part of it, and he would circle around. His sons don't. His sons live in Beersheba, all the way down in the boondocks. And they don't seem to be willing to undergo this circuitry, to continue to be a traveling judge as their father was. They also aren't known for the same stellar reputation their father had. They're known for perverting justice and taking bribes. And again, I don't want to go into exactly what they were doing or what they weren't doing, but they weren't upright standing citizens, and Bnei Israel don't want them to be a king. So once again, they ask Hashem for, not once again, they ask Hashem for a king, echoing the words that we had seen earlier in Sefer Dvarim, Kechol Hagoyim. Shmuel feels that it's a slap in his face that they are asking for a king. Hashem disagrees. No, they're angry with me. But either way, give them a king. What sort of a king? We're going to discuss that when we look at Shmuel, but let's recall some of the things that the king is going to have to deal with as he assumes his reign. On the military front, the king will be responsible for protecting the nation from the external enemies, against the all-too-prevalent force of the Plishtim and whoever else decides to attack. On the religious level, the king will have to protect them from the internal enemies, from the ongoing and constant influence they feel from their neighbors to keep the people in line, as Shmuel had finally been able to get them to do. We saw examples of the customs that Israel had adopted from the surrounding people, and we discussed what Darchei Amori was, and I want to go into that a little bit more right now to understand what Shaul's task is going to be as he begins to be king. Again, in a source you don't have, I'd like to read from the end of Parshat Kedoshim, which again is where all the rules that we are going to then see in Shmuel Aleph are first mentioned. It's Perek Yotet Pasuk Chav Gimel. V'ki tabo el ha'aretz, unetatem kol etz ma'achal, v'arlatem orlato et perio shalosh shanim, yelachem arilim lo ya'achel. When you come to the land of Israel, says the Torah, you will begin to adhere to the mitzvah of orla. When you plant a tree, you must wait for 3 years before you can begin to eat it. U'b'shana ha'revi'i tiye kol perio kodesh, yelulim ma'ashem, the fourth year, it will be considered kadosh. And you'll be permitted to eat it the fifth year. Next pasuk, lo tochlu al hadam, don't eat on the blood. Lo tenachashu, lo teonenu. We'll describe those terms in a moment. Lo tekitu pe'at rashecha, lo tashvi pe'at zekancha. One of the few mitzvot lo taseh that applies only to men, the mitzvah of not cutting the peyot. V'sheret l'nefesh lo titnu v'v'seret l'nefesh lo titnu v'v'yasarchem u'ktovet kaka lo titnu v'achem ani Hashem. We're not allowed to gouge ourselves. which was a sign of mourning in the Amori, and we're not allowed to tattoo ourselves, because if we do it, Tizneh Ha'arj and Lama Ha'arj Zima. These are all forms of what people had done around us, and we can't follow in their ways. So first of all, how is Orla connected to these other mitzvot, which seem to be mitzvot relating to the Amori? Orla seems to be connected to Shmita and to Yovel and to other mitzvot ha'tluot ba'aretz. If you'll look with me at source 19, we're going a little bit out of order. The Abarbanel is going to explain how this relates. And his question is, Lama samach mitzvata orla mitzvot lo tochlu al adam, lo tenachashu v'lo te'omenu, v'shar mitzvot shebao beparshat she'en minyan. Now, what is the connection between orla and the other mitzvot? V'chita bo el ha'aretz, unetatem kol etz machal ad inyan hamolech. Hanirei betam yisur ha'ola, umashe ketav harav ha'more, beperk lamed zayin chelik imun. שציבה בה יתברך להפריקינו מעקום שהייתה מעבודת בימים הקדמונים לעשות דברים ידועים אצלם בעת נטיית האילנות ויחשבו שמפני זה ימהר לבוא הפרי קודם זמנו. That there seemed to have been an influence in the beginning, that a custom among the other nations, that they would do some sort of magic in order to hurry the ripening process. And for that reason, we have been instructed not to hurry. And not only can't we hurry the ripening process, it wouldn't help us anyway because we're not allowed to eat from the fruit. All of this is a gedder, is a fence, is a prohibition to make sure that we don't get involved in these customs. And if you'll skip down to about halfway through, he talks about that there are three different types of mitzvot that are connected to the land of Israel. Atati dash mitzvata karka hen migimo minim kifitach liyotehem. Ha'achan mitne shakarka shetziva yitbarach shishvot kmitzvata shmita vayovel. The first type of mitzvot relating to the land of Israel are to give the land a rest, as we see in Shmita and Yovel. Habet liyotam mazon lekonim. We also have laws relating to the land that help us provide food for the people whose job it is to help us religiously and spiritually, to help provide food for the Kohanim and Levi'im, who serve as our teachers, who work for us in the Beit HaMikdash. Mishartei Hashem, Ketruma, Bahamaser, Bahabikurim. Vahagimel, Hulaharchakat Akum, Kimo Hakilayim, Vahorla, Vidomehem. And the third level of prohibition, or laws relating to the land, are those laws which are going to separate us from our neighbors and help protect us against their influence. Therefore, we have the prohibition of kilayim, of mixtures, of orla, which we discussed, and other mitzvot of those types. And he goes on to say that that is why orla applies not just in the land of Israel. It applies outside the land of Israel as well. Why then were they told to do the mitzvah when they got to the land of Israel? Simply, they weren't planting trees in the desert. And also, there weren't nations around them that they had to worry about learning from them what the laws of planting trees and all the other nonsense. So it was really more of a time-related injunction, ki tavo el ha'aretz. That's when you're going to need to worry about it, as opposed to this is a law that only applies in the land. As we continue to look into what Darchei Emori, we're going to go backwards to source 18, to the Gemara in Shabbos, and the discussion there, whether it has any medical benefit, if it's still considered Darchei Emori or not. And I'd like to look at the third line, where really it's going to sum up the debate. Kol davar sheyesh bo mishum refuah, ein bo mishum Darchei Emori. Ha'ein bo mishum refuah, ein bo mishum Darchei Emori. That anything that you can claim has a legitimate medical purpose to it is not going to be considered from the superstitious nature, but if it can be proven to be beneficial, it's going to be considered Darchei Emori. The Rishonim will then discuss whether it's a placebo, whether placebos are considered legitimate or not, and we're going to have the Rashba on the one hand and the Rambam on the other, where the Rambam is going to be very, no, it can't be done, Only things that can be scientifically proven can be considered as refua. Everything else is nonsense and is going to lead to avodah zarah. Where the Rashba is going to allow, as long as you realize that all refua comes from Hashem, even if it's not proven scientifically, we're going to allow it. Again, that's going to take us beyond the parameters right here, but just to give us a taste of what we're talking about when we're discussing Michush and Inun and all these other mitzvot. Now I'd like to get specifically into the cases that are found in Shmuel Aleph. And when I promised you that we were going to go over the terms of the Pesukim, we're going to go through the different aspects as we see them in the narrative. So Lot Nachashu, that's going to be the first thing that we're going to look at right now. What is Lot Nachashu? Rav Hirsch, known for his etymologies, likens the word Nihush to Nachash in the same way a snake is going to slither from one point to the next. He says that somebody who's going to go from point A to point B and make whatever connection he wants between the two events. It rained in the morning, and I had a stomachache. Therefore, if it's going to rain tomorrow morning, I better be careful because I'm going to have a stomachache as well. Is there any connection between the stomachache and the fact that it rained? Of course not. But you think that there is one, and therefore, that is what you're going to do. That is a form of Lot Nachashu. The problem with what you are doing, and I'm reading from the Rav Hirsch, again, you don't have this in front of you, but just you can listen. Nihush this time would be senseless, laughable, if it did not at the same time involve a denial of God's free-willed government of the world and exercise a pernicious checking influence on man's free-willed activity, for which regarding their purpose and their disability or moral necessity, God has referred us solely to the Torah. That we're willing to accept that this outside force is governing the relationship between two unconnected events rather than seeing it either I chose, I really had a stomachache because I ate food that wasn't good for my stomach, or Yad Hashem Badabar, Hashem decided I needed to have a stomachache for whatever reason, and that's why I had one, not because of anything to do with the weather that morning. We're going to look right now at a case of possible nihush in Shmuel Aleph. And I say possible because it's a huge debate, and we'll see both cases. The reason I'm bringing it in is the fact that we might even attribute nihush to somebody gives us a sense that a lot of this was going on at the time. And the story we're going to look at is the story of Yonatan. In a later parak, Shaul has now been made king, and they're fighting against the Plishtim once again. The parak will open with a scene of Shaul and his men sitting around waiting for the action to begin. And Yonatan, loath to wait around, more impetuous, will try and figure out maybe he can jumpstart the battle on his own. And in the sources, in source number 5, he's going to turn to his Nosei Kelim and say the following in Pasuk Vav. Vayomer Yonatan el Hanar Nosei Kelav, Lecha b'na Avraham matav ha'arelim ha'ele, ulai yaseh Hashem lanu, ki em Hashem mansur loshi b'rabo b'me'at. Let's appear in front of that group of plishtim over there, because what difference does it make to Hashem if he's going to save with a few people or with a lot? A little bit of a Hanukkah reference here. I promised you some. Do whatever you think. He had a very willing Nosei Kelim. We're going to appear in front of this group of Plishtim. In koyim ru elenu, domu ad hegienu elechem, v'amanu tachteinu v'lo na'ale alehem. If they tell us, stand where you are, we're ready to come down, that's a sign that we should not go and try and attack. In koyimru alu elenu va'alenu kinatanam Hashem biyadenu v'zelanu ha'ot. But if as we appear they say, come on up, it's a sign that Hashem is giving us as that we're going to be able to be successful. In source 13, the Talmud Bavli in Chulin says clearly that this is a form of nihush and is prohibited. Vahamar Rav Kol Nachash Eino Keliezer Eben Abraham Yonatan Ben Shaul Eino Nachash. That if you are not doing something like Eliezer or Yehonatan, it's not Nachash. Ergo, if you did like they did, you have done Nihush. What did Yonatan do? He tried to figure out the condition of the Plishtim by creating a sign. What did Eliezer do? He tried to make a deal to figure out who the best wife for Yitzchak would be. And the Rambam, in source 13, the last line, וכן המסים סימנים לעצמו אם יערה לי כך וכך אעשה דבר פלוני ואם לא יערה לי לא אעשה. If somebody makes a deal that if such and such happens to me, I will continue on my way, and if not, I won't. Like Eliezer ben Abraham, וכן כל קיוטי בדברים האלו, הכל אסור, וכל העושה מעשה מפני דבר מדברים אלו לוקה. This is all forms of the prohibition of Yehush. None of it is possible. But if we re-examine both the story of Eliezer, who wasn't Jewish, so we don't necessarily know that there's a problem with him doing Yehush anyway, but let's put that argument aside. If we try and look at Eliezer and Yonatan and their deal with God in a different light, as does the Sforno in source 14, he sees not a form of Yehush, of trying to connect A and B when there seems no apparent connection between the two, but rather as a form of tefillah. Vayahanara asher omar eleha, hitpalel. He was begging Hashem for help. Please, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm on an impossible mission right now. This is what I would like you to do to help me out. And similarly, he says, Yehonatan ben Shaul eno nachash, also praying, discussing with HaKadosh Baruch Hu different possibilities. So not this mindless connection between two points, but imploring of God to help them be successful. The Radak agrees with the Sforno in terms of it's not being Yehush, but is going to prove it from the end. And his last, his concluding line in source 15, Im haya asur, lo haya HaKadosh Baruch Hu ozro b'halicha hahi. It can't have been wrong. Why? It worked. If it worked, therefore, Hashem must not feel that it's Nihush. So whatever it wasn't Nihush. He doesn't necessarily tell us it was Tefillah, but he says it wasn't wrong. In source 17, the Kesef Mishnah, Rabbi Yosef Karo, known to us usually as the Shulchan Aruch, is going to give us another way other than the Tefillah why what Eliezer and Yonatan did was okay. אבל הלוקח סימנים בדבר שהצברה מחרד שהם מורים תועלת הדבר או נזכור אין זה נחש. If you're looking to make a calculated decision based on things that you can see with your eyes, that is not ניחוש, that is being smart. שכל עסקי העולם כך, this is how all the world works. שהרי אומר אם ירדו גשמים לא אצא לדרך. If you're saying that if it rains I'm not going to go out on whatever journey it was that I meant to go on, that's a sensible thing to do. The roads are going to be stuck. You're going to be at lost with the inclement weather. Why should you go? Ve'im lav etzeh ein zo nichush. Ela min hagosh el olam. Ve'eliezer ve'yonatan kiyotzeh bazeh talu ma'aseihem. Similarly, both Yonatan and Eliezer were making common sense arguments. She'eliezer yodea haya shelo hayu mizavkin isha li'yitzchak ela hogenet lo. He knew he had to find an appropriate wife for Yitzchak. לפיכך לקח סימן לעצמו שאם תהיה כל כך נאה במעשיה ושלמה במידותיה עד כשאמר לה הגמיני נא מעט מים תשיבהו ברוח נדיבה גם גמלך אשגה אותה היא שהזמינו מן השמיים ליצחק. He knew he had to find a very special woman of exceptional moral character, very giving, to be fit to be a wife for Yitzchak. And therefore he said, let me ask her for water. And if it turns out she's so generous that she's willing to water the camels as well, that's the sort of woman who's going to be appropriate for Yitzchak. וכן יונתן שביקש לעקוד במחנה פלישתים הוא בנושא כליו, בלבד לקח סימן זה, שאם יאמרו אליו, עלו אלינו, יהיה נראה שהם יראים מערב, וכיוצא בו, בטח יונתן בגבורתו שהוא בנושא כליו יפגעו בהם, שכן מנהגו של עולם, ששניים או שלושה אבירי לב יניסו הרבה מהמופחדים. That if they say, come on up to us, it means that they're scared. I would add it would mean that they're not organized, they're not ready for war. And Yonatan knew that the surprise attack theory, that a few can overcome many if you're taking everybody by surprise, especially if they're not organized, especially if they're scared to begin with. So the sign of come up to us really indicated the presence or the position that the camp was in at that time. ואם יורו דומו עד הגיינו אליכם, יראה מדבריהם שאינם מפחדים, וכיוצא בזה לא היה ראוי ליונתן שימסור עצמו לסכנה, וכל כיוצא בזה מנהגו של עולם הוא. But if they said, wait, we're coming down to you, they were organized, they were ready for battle, they weren't scared. All of these signs to Yonatan that I'm not going to have the element of surprise, I'm not going to be able to take them at a disadvantage. I'm going to need more than myself and my Nosei Kelim to be successful in my mission against them, and we're not going to proceed with this plan. Again, not nifush, not looking for far-fetched signs, but signs based on reason. So again, if it's not nifush, why am I including it here? The fact that we can consider that they were undergoing nifush means that it must have occurred at this time. We wouldn't just put in a story if it didn't have any sense whatsoever. A more clear-cut case. Lo tochlu al adam, lo tenafashu, lo te'onenu. We're going to now look at a case of lo tochlu al hadam. And the story actually is a continuation of what we had seen in Perek Yudalet. So I'll ask you to look back at source number 5 at the second part. Shaul does appear to the Plishtim. They tell him to come up. He goes up with his Nosei Kelav, and they are successful in creating havoc in the camp. Shaul and Bnei Israel see this from afar, and they're going to go to war to finish up what Yonatan has started, not knowing that Yonatan was the reason that they have this head start over everything else. Shaul decides that in order to keep the people focused on the job, in order to show HaKadosh Baruch Hu how committed they are to the mission, they will not be allowed to eat. Yonatan, who will be eating by the end of the day, and it's actually in some of the psukim that are listed here, and who has not heard this injunction of his father, tastes from the honey so that he doesn't faint, and that incurs a whole other set of problems. Shaul feels that he should be put to death, and Israel are going to advocate for his clemency. But what I want to look at is what happens with the rest of Israel, starting with Pasuk Lamed Bet. At the end of the day, they too are exhausted. They too are very, very hungry. Vayat am el hashalal v'kum sonu v'kar uvnei v'kar v'ishchetu arza. And once the war is over, they're going to fall, literally, like an eagle preying on its prey. They're going to look at the meat, the tzonu bakar, they're going to slaughter it. V'yochal ha'am al hadam. They're going to eat on the blood. We still don't know exactly what this means, but we do know what is a general thought from the next pasuk. V'yigidu l'shaul l'mor, hinei ha'am chotim la'ashem l'chol al hadam. They're doing something wrong, they're eating on the blood. And what does Shaul do and say? Vayomer begaditem golu ilai hayom eben gedola. He asks for a big rock. Vayomer Shaul patsu ba'am v'amartim lahem hagishu ilai ish som shorov ish diyehu ushatetem bazeh v'achaltem v'lo techatu la'ashem l'chol elhu. So again, we're not quite sure what they did wrong, and we're not quite sure how he's fixing it, but it seems to involve bringing some sort of stone and organizing a communal place for the slaughtering to take place so that they do not sin by eating on the blood. Source 8. Rashi, on Lo Tochlu Al Hadam in Vayikra, is going to give us two possibilities. L'harbeh panim midrash b'Sanhedrin, it's explained a lot in the Sechet Sanhedrin, he tells us, Azarasha lo yochal mi basar kodshim lifnei zrikat adam, bazara lo ochel mi behemot chulei term shetitzei nafsha. And he's really looking at our story to try and get which ones make the most sense. Either what Bnei Israel were eating in Sefer Shmuel was a korban, and they were eating from the meat before the blood had been thrown on the rock. Therefore, Shaul rectifies the situation by having a communal place to serve as a mizbeach. They will be able to do zrikat hadam. They can continue eating their korban, and they won't be eating al hadam. They won't be eating before the dam has been disposed of properly. Or it wasn't a korban, it was basar chulin, regular blood, but everybody was just shechting it on the spot and the blood wasn't able to drain away properly as it should. And again, what we see Shaul doing helps us to understand he had a communal place for them to start shechting the animals. They were able to drain it properly and then they too were eating al hadam. Source 11 will also show us that he's following in the same idea with those two possibilities. This was Rashi and Shmuel Aleph. Source 9 can show us the original sources in the Gemara. There are many of them, including injunctions to those dami dinim mavet, dinim nefashot, those putting somebody to death for capital crime that you can't. The judges can't eat. Lo tachu al adam. If you're judging that somebody has to have his dam spilled, you can't eat. And that the family would then not have a sudat haba'ah. What's going to interest me more right now is source number 10, the Ramban, specifically beginning with the word al derech hapshat. Al derech hapshat, hu min minine hakishuv o aksamim, Kihu davar lamad miinyano, vayu shofrim hadam, umeasfim ota beguma, vashedim mitkabtsim sham kepid atam, vochlim al shulchanam lagid lahem atidot. Ramban is learning from the juxtaposition of lot tohu al adam with lot nachashu lot onenu, davar lamad miinyano, that this was another form of kishub, that they used to look at the blood to try and figure out the fortune. Ramban will tell us something similar with Orlas. If you remember, all of these psukim are customs they would be learning from people around them. And the irony, says the Ramban, of Bnei Israel at this time, Hashem had just helped them win a victory against the Plishtim. And what were they doing since they were still scared? Looking at outside sources, achilat al hadam, using the blood to try and ascertain if they were going to continuously be victorious or not. And that is what Shaul got so upset with, and he rectified the situation, he removed the blood, they weren't able to eat by looking at the blood, by gathering it, and life continued. This happens to be a very positive moment in Shaul's career as king, where we see him actively battling against the Darchei Amori that has pervaded all the way through. The Ralbag in source 12, will concur with the Ramban, the Ravag is on Shmuel here, that this is part of the Umanot Nifsedot Shahayu Az. It's part of these false beliefs that people had at this time. And that's what Shaul was trying to get rid of. So far we've seen the idea of Nechush, we've seen the idea of Achilat al Hadam. Trafim, we'll see it quickly in source 6. When David is running away from Shaul and Michal helps him to escape, she sends him out the window, Rapunzel-like, and manages to cover up his absence by putting trafim under her blankets. What the trafim were is open for debate. They seem to be man-like figurines, either small, as in the case of Rachel, larger in the case of Michal, that seem to help tell the future, indicate times that were going to be happening. I envision something like a magic ball, the crystal ball, and the Wizard of Oz, in order to tell the futures. Again, not Avodah Zarah, but the Darchei Amori, the Avak Avodah Zarah. And again, we can see the prevalence. If the daughter of the king has them, you have to believe that other people in the neighborhood have them as well. Finally, the last episode we're going to see, Shaul himself involved in a balad of incident. What makes this story ironic is the fact that he had just eradicated all the Baalov and Yiduni from the country. Again, a very positive move. What also makes it ironic is that in the earlier battle we saw, the one that was in Perek Yudalit, he was supposed to have waited for Shmuel to consult with Hashem about going out to war, but he can't. The war's about to begin, and he jump starts by going ahead without talking to Shmuel and waiting. Here, when he's getting ready to go out to battle, there will be a battle the next day where he will ultimately die in Har HaGilboa, and where he can't talk to Shmuel anymore because Shmuel has already died, here he refuses to go out to war without talking first to Shmuel. And the only means at his disposal is with the Balat Ov. There's major debate whether this actually happened. Was the Balat Ov able to tell Shaul certain facts about his life because they were public knowledge? You're going to die tomorrow. She knew there was a war. She knew he was being punished. Their kingdom is going to go to the hands of David. At that point, everybody knew that David was going to be king. that Hashem no longer wanted him to become king. Again, these were all the words that had been told beforehand, and she was able to bring them together. That's quoted in the Radak as the position of Rav Shmuel ben Chachmi Gaon, or whether in this case it really did happen, which is the position of Rav Sadia Gaon, again quoted in the Radak, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Bichvod Shmuel, actually allows this to happen. And she's surprised that it's actually working. Never in her whole career has it actually worked. It's all been a form of trickery, and here suddenly Shmuel is coming out to talk. But again, what we see is this creeping in of the Darchei Amorim. So what is the position that I'm trying to show you? That throughout the beginning of Shmuel Aleph, we have these threads. Suddenly, after Parakafet, we're not going to see them anymore. There are no more stories of Trafim, there's no more stories of Nichush, there's no more stories of Achilat al-Hadar. Why not? What happens? Quite frankly, Shaul dies and David takes over. What is the difference between David and Shaul? Why is Shaul bewitched, befuddled, bemused, and David is not? Suggest what Stein felt, that what enabled Shaul to become king was this sudden transformation. He's given three signs from Shmuel. The third one being, you're going to become a Nabi, you're going to meet a group of Midian and begin to prophesize with them. That the sudden transformation was maybe almost too quick, too much for him to handle. As long as the Ruach Hashem is with him, as long as he's doing what Hashem is telling him to do, all will be fine. The minute he begins not to, the minute the Ruach Hashem is taken away, in its vacuum is going to grow the Ruach Ra'av. As quickly as he shifted over, he's going to shift back. So whatever good we see him being able to do in the beginning in eradicating Achilat al-Adam and trying to get rid of Oven Yiduni, ultimately the forces are going to be too strong for him, and he in fact is going to succumb to the same pressure that he was trying to prevent Bnei Israel, that he should have been preventing Bnei Israel because that was his job as a king. How is David different? From the first time we meet David, we're told that Ruach Elohim bo. There's something already innate with him. He doesn't need this sudden infusion because it's intrinsic. He's already able to fight these forces. He's already able to be a role model to Bnei Israel in this regard. The connection to Hanukkah that I've promised. We can somehow looking at blood, what nonsense is it? Lot Nachashu making these deals, what sort of nonsense is it? If we look at Hellenism and their involvement in the Greek society, I don't know that they would have thought that all of that was nonsense. Again, they might have laughed at the specific examples, the Canaanite examples, but there were certainly their own Greek examples they were getting sucked into as well. We can also connect it to the choice of role models. If you need a king, if you need this person who has the power over everybody to set you on the right course, which we saw David HaMelech was able to do, the choice in the Hashmonaim ultimately does not prove to be a very successful choice for Bnei Israel to counter the effects of the society, and they're going to go downward as well. And if we connect it to ourselves today, how many of us can laugh? Yes, horoscopes, but they're out there. Tarot cards, every block you go to, someone else is promising to tell you the future. It's a force that's out there, and it's something that we battle with constantly, depending on how much we laugh, and really, and what, and maybe. And I would suggest that the same way David was able to help come and counter that, that's what we need today, this role model to help show us clearly what's right and wrong. B'mhirah v'yameinu. Chag Sameach.